Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. Hi, it's the Capital Connection. This is David Gustina. Joining us today, State Senator James Skoufis. He's a Democrat from New York's 42nd District. He is the chair of the Senate Committee on Investigations and Government Operations. And we welcome back Senator Skoufis to the Capital Connection. Thanks for being with us.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Let's start hot, shall we? We'll get your temperature to rise, I'm sure. When I bring up Central Hudson and the Public Service Commission, that's the PSC. Now, there's been all sorts of problems. You've told us about this in the past with rate hikes, overcharging customers. But side by side with that, they asked for a rate hike along with National Grid. And it seemed like within 24 to 48 hours, they got it. And, you know, at a time when the governor of New York, Kathy Hochul, has tried to put up an affordability agenda, this is the worst kind of price hike that many New Yorkers who can't afford it are getting.
That's right. The outcome here that you just described for Central Hudson customers and the system generally, the process, is a disgrace. And here's why. It's really become a game for these utilities when it comes to moving forward and convincing, quote unquote, the PSC to approve a rate hike. And here's why. At some point in a board meeting, likely somewhere in these utilities' headquarters, they cook up some number. This is the rate hike that we really want, you know, 10%, 12%, 15% increase, whatever it is. And then they make the decision, well, to get to that 15%, you know, we should start with an application at 22% because we know the PSC will knock us down. They'll knock us down to generally where we want to be anyway. And then here's what happens inevitably every single time. The PSC approves roughly the number that the utility wanted to begin with. The PSC puts out a press release celebrating how they really took it to the utility and chopped their application in half or 40% or whatever it is. Meanwhile, it's what the utility wanted the entire time. And the loser, every single situation here, is the ratepayer, the customer, the taxpayer in New York State. And so it is the game that is played every time. Now, the one time in my 13 years that I've seen this game not quite play out how I just described was about a year ago. Central Hudson had a rate hike about a year or so ago approved. It was objectively much smaller than Central Hudson had actually desired, not the stated application number, but what they actually wanted. The approved number was lower than what they were looking for. And so what did they do? They just turned around literally weeks later and put in a new second application. Usually utilities wait 3-4 years before they circle back and put in another rate hike. They turned on a dime because they didn't get the number they wanted, put it in again, and then, you know, several months go by and then they get another rate hike. It is a broken system. It's a disgraceful system. The governor needs to do something. The legislature needs to do something because, you know, this is untenable, and it is one of the primary factors, one of the primary drivers that is sending folks out of this state, the escalating, outrageous, untenable utility bills that exist.
Yeah, I want to add that when you approve these rate hikes, as far as I can see, there was a matter of weeks, a month maybe, for that rate hike to take effect. How can people plan their budgets when it gets voted in August and they have to start paying up in September?
Well, to answer your question, they can't. They can't plan. And I'm especially sympathetic to folks who are on a fixed income and they get a small Social Security check, maybe a small pension. They're struggling to pay their property tax bills. They're right on the edge. And now they've got to pay during the wintertime $100 more in their heating bill. A lot of folks can't do it. And it's why a lot of folks are leaving New York State. And so we took some modest but still meaningful steps in the right direction on the affordability issue earlier this year. We should have done a lot more. We could have done a lot more. But things like universal school meal, that's going to save families a lot of money if you've got kids in school. You know, a lot of that progress, as modest as it was, It's wiped out when you've got a rate hike that's approved and you're paying more for AC in the summer to, you know, stay sane and cool in your home and not have a heat stroke and certainly stay warm in the winter.
So you sort of put it right on the line. You said we got to rip this thing apart down to the studs if we need to. How does that happen? How do you reconstitute the Public Service Commission, if you can?
Well, I think we've got to start from scratch. There's no more in my mind space for tinkering around the edges here where, you know, we pass a bill that maybe changes one tiny element of this process. I think we have to look at what all the other 49 states do, see what works, what doesn't work. And my staff and other offices, by the way, are doing exactly what I'm describing now, because there are some states that are not seeing their energy prices escalating anywhere near as high as they are escalating here in New York. And now certainly we have laws in place that other states don't have in place that speak to a transition to renewable energy and other regulations and rules around generation and transmission. And so it's not going to be completely apples to apples, but you go to the middle of the country, for example, and they're just not seeing the crisis at the level that we are seeing here in New York State. So I think we've got to metaphorically blow the place up. We've got to start from scratch, and we've got to consider all of our options here. Now, back in the day, I'm not suggesting this is the solution because I think this would be a very problematic response. But back in the day, to give your listeners an example of the possible options that are out there, the legislature used to be the ones who voted on rate hikes. Now, right. I think that injects a lot of politics, and that would be a whole set of other problems. But there are other ways to do this, and we've got to consider them all.
We're speaking with Senator James Skoufis, a Democrat from New York's 42nd Senate District, on the Capitol Connection. I am David Gustina. Senator Skoufis, dawns on me, you know, this idea of energy hikes, the idea of energy and the environment, it's all concomitant. I mean, when you look at what's happening with some of the rebates, for example, now we're talking about Lee Zeldin, the EPA, we're talking about deregulating the industry, and we're seeing, for example, federal rebates on electric and hybrid vehicles going away. We're already seeing price hikes because of tariffs on these vehicles. Solar rebates, all sorts of things. NYSERDA, the authority, is not offering what they once offered. And we've been acknowledging in New York that we're not going to make our climate goals. You know, it dawns on me that just let's say you own a hybrid or an electric vehicle, that's direct savings in consumers' pockets by not paying for fuel.
That's right. I myself own a hybrid. And, you know, I think there are a lot of folks like myself who have been waiting for the charging infrastructure in New York State to build out more before moving to an electric vehicle, which is something that I and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of New Yorkers would love to do. And so I happen to think that, and as you know, and we might talk about this a little bit later, I'm someone who looks through a critical lens at a lot of subsidies. One of the areas that there is definitely a role for subsidies to play is this transition to a more renewable economy. Because at the end of the day, unless you, as a state government in this instance, but certainly the federal government, which is pulling back from a lot of these incentives, as you rightfully noted, unless government is out front and bringing down the costs of these otherwise extremely expensive technologies, whether it's solar panels on your roof as a single family homeowner, whether it's an electric vehicle, you know, these are in many cases for families prohibitively expensive without a subsidy. Now, the goal is that once you have enough consumers, enough residents who are mass buying these technologies, then, you know, by virtue of economies of scale, the price theoretically should come down over time. But you pull away those subsidies, you pull away most families' ability to buy, and the price is going to remain high. And so, you know, this one isn't as simple as just free market economics. One, it's good for the environment, but two, the price is just out of reach unless you, as a government, facilitate an economies of scale, mass purchasing that brings down for producers and others who will know that you've got hundreds of thousands, millions of New Yorkers as consumers waiting on the other end thanks to subsidies. Short of that, the price will remain too high for folks and out of reach.
So, Senator Skoufis, let's carry this forward. Let's talk about it now. You know, where do we go from here? Does the state start to provide these subsidies? So, for example, you know, one of the things that was talked about for a while was, is New York going to get back in special session knowing what's coming from the federal government? That has not happened yet, but there's still time. Obviously, the Democrats, your party, is going to use a lot of these cuts to hammer the Republicans. But in the meantime, New Yorkers are left waiting to know what's going to happen. So do you, in your mind, see the governor addressing these issues in the coming session? Will we see subsidies to help protect New Yorkers over these issues, one being environmental?
It's possible. You know, my crystal ball works as well as yours does, which is not at all. And the pressure point here is that due to federal actions, and, you know, we're talking about what I'll call the one big ugly bill that was signed on July 4th, due to that legislation, we have a gaping $10+ billion hole in our next budget. And that's, by the way, not to even mention the $13 billion hole that is going to be shot through our healthcare system, our hospitals, our health centers throughout New York State. And so combined, we're talking $20+ billion that suddenly, over the course of the next year or so, is going to be ripped away from either our state budget, our state government, or, you know, our critical healthcare system here in New York. And so I raise this for context purposes. You know, do we have the funds? Do we have the change under the couch cushions in Albany to establish new, at times, fairly expensive subsidies, even if it's good public policy, even if it's worthwhile and, you know, on the merits, something smart to do? You know, there's going to be a lot of pressure to backfill these Medicaid cuts that are coming. There's already a lot of pressure to backfill the hospital budgets, who many of whom will be threatening closure without some affirmative state action and resources. And so, you know, there's going to be a lot of push and pull. There's always reticence about, you know, raising taxes, particularly on non-millionaires. I'm comfortable on raising very modestly some taxes on folks who make millions and millions of dollars. But, you know, it's a budget. And unlike the federal government, we need a balanced budget every year in New York. It's going to be a challenge.
Certainly is going to be a challenge. I wonder, do you think that the rich should be taxed more when we're going to need more money to fill the hole?
I think it's a conversation we have to have. You know, the governor has, up to this point, been very opposed to having that conversation. And look, you know, her position is you raise taxes anymore on the very rich. And for me, that means, you know, you're making 7+ figures a year and, you know, millions of dollars. You raise their taxes and, you know, it's a mobile economy since COVID. You know, people can take Zoom meetings and we're going to drive these taxpayers out of New York. I'm of the opinion that if you really focus on, you know, the state income tax rates for these highest earners, you do it in a very, very modest way. We're talking, you know, a fraction of a percent, 1 or 2 percentage points. I don't think there are too many people, if anybody, who are going to say, well, New York State just raised my taxes by 0.8%. Like, I'm moving out of here. At the end of the day, we still offer so much more than most states here in New York, including in New York City, where, you know, these very wealthy New Yorkers, they sit on, you know, the board of fancy private schools that their kids attend that are the best in the country. They enjoy going to Broadway shows. They love their home out in the Hamptons. And you're going to give all that up, you know, over a 0.8% or a 1.1%, whatever it is.
And don't forget, Senator, don't forget, Senator Skoufis, the largesse coming from the federal government is going to help the rich as well.
That's right. And, you know, you talk about probably one of the only things that, you know, was advantageous to us here in New York was they increased the SALT cap from $10,000 to $40,000, right, which will disproportionately, you know, assist folks who, you know, live in much larger houses than you or I likely live in. So look, you know, I think it's a conversation we have to have. You're going to have a new mayor in New York City who, you know, has made a lot of campaign promises, assuming he wins in November. And the large majority of those campaign promises cannot be filled unless New York State, not New York City, New York State agrees to raise revenue and pay for free buses and free childcare or tuition-free CUNY or the various other programs, many of which are worthwhile and that I support, but can't be done with the current contours of our revenue and our state budget.
Well, you brought up the New York City mayor's race. It makes sense to at least go there for a moment. Are you supportive of Mr. Mamdani?
Democrats need to learn a lesson from this campaign. And it's interesting to me, and quite frankly, I view it as political malpractice. and just the wrong thing to do, where you've got all these Democrats who are running for the hills away from, the Democratic nominee. You've got leaders of our party, state and national, running for the hill. Oh, like they're taking a meeting with him. They're ongoing conversations. Give me a freaking break. We all know why you're running for the hills. And it's because of, a handful of large donors who, are reticent, to put it mildly, about Zohran. And so, look, I happen to think that most of his ideas, like these are not crazy ideas. I brought free buses to Orange County. Ridership doubled. What a crazy idea. We talk about making CUNY tuition free. I've carried legislation to make SUNY and CUNY, our public colleges in New York, tuition free. I've carried this bill for the past decade. CUNY used to be tuition free for the better part of a century up until just only a few decades ago. What a crazy idea. I'm a center-left Democrat. I have no problem believing and taking these positions because they're good public policy positions. And so at the end of the day, assuming he wins in November, we as Democrats need to acknowledge that he has animated a cohort of voters. I'm talking non-voters or infrequent voters and certainly young voters who we as a Democratic Party, broadly speaking, have been enormously challenged to animate. And we have to figure out as Democrats and, whether you're a center-left Democrat or conservative or even a left Democrat, there are only three individuals that come to my mind since the Obama 2008 campaign that have really, really energized young voters and infrequent voters that would otherwise be a lot allied with our party. The three are AOC, Bernie, and Zohran. We have a problem if it is only a Democratic socialist who is able to animate these voters. We've got to figure out how to, and I've got some ideas, but we as a party broadly have to figure out how to, energize and build trust with these voters without necessarily having to be a Democratic socialist.
Senator James Skoufis, I appreciate those remarks. Let me just add to them by saying this political wheel has been going around for a long time with the Democratic Party. Let's go back to the race in which Hillary Clinton ended up with a nomination instead of Bernie Sanders. The Democratic Party has a problem with the left flank of their party because every time someone from the progressives wins, they call them socialists or communists. And the center to more conservative part of the Democrats run for the hills. So while I agree some of it may be the donors, it's also this constant problem that politicians seem to have on the Democratic side, especially with being labeled a socialist, when that is not necessarily accurate. And when democratic socialism seems to please a lot of people in that some of their basic needs get taken care of. I just saw a poll from Siena, 66% support these ideas. So when it comes to this issue, I think this is a long-held history in the party, don't you?
Well, there's some bad faith in both directions here. And you rightfully noted, a higher profile example or two of the center or center left of the party not embracing nominees who are further to the left. But let's also be clear. Everyone remembers you mentioned Hillary. That example works both ways. The Bernie Bros, as they were referred to as in that 2016 cycle, they refused to come out and vote for Hillary. And, when you have such a close election as you had in November 2016, if one of, 27 things had gone a little bit differently, the election likely would have had a different outcome. But one of those 27 things was you had a meaningful number of quote unquote Bernie Bros who sat in the sidelines and did not support the Democratic nominee that year. And so, it works both ways. We all have to figure out and acknowledge and build some bridges here and understand that the Democratic Party is only successful when we are a big tent. And since 2008, our tent has been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking every election cycle to the point now where the Teamsters didn't even endorse our Democratic nominee for president last time around. And we're you know, the Firefighters Union didn't even endorse our Democratic nominee for president last time around. And certainly there's been a lot of conversation, rightfully so, on, you know, how much we have hemorrhaged, not only with white working class voters, but, voters who have been a core part of our base for decades, including, black men and especially younger Hispanic men. And so, you know, we need to understand that there's room for everyone from the left to the center within our party. And for those who don't buy into that, they're really, I believe, conceding electoral success. At the end of the day, 99 times out of 100 in the year 2025, the Democratic nominee is going to win in a place like New York City. Guess what? Most of the country is not politically like New York City. You go an hour north of New York City to Orange County, Donald Trump won my district by 12 percentage points. And so the only way that we are successful, again, is if we've got a big tent that we are not kicking anybody out of. We're not going to agree on everything, but we need to build trust and begin to build those bridges that for far too long, as you mentioned, and as I highlighted as well, there's just been bad faith in both directions for a long time.
Yeah, I agree with those comments. I also want to point out that Bernie Sanders and AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, are going around the country, not just New York. They're going around the country and filling stadiums with people. How can we say, as we hear a lot, that the Democrats are in disarray when you've got two candidates here who are going around drawing in thousands and thousands of people with their message? This is what you're talking about with sort of embracing Zohran Mamdani in New York City.
Yeah, and I think as Democrats, we should want as much of that as possible, harnessing the energy, the anger, the frustration that is very clearly out there in every corner of this country, including some of the reddest states and the reddest communities in those red states. Let's also be clear, though, while certainly I think they're probably the highest profile folks who have been holding these events around the country, the DNC has organized over 100 town halls throughout the country, which is something the DNC typically hasn't engaged in. Usually they're just a money in, money out type of a national apparatus. And in these town halls, there are hundreds, thousands of people who are showing up to listen to Democratic congressmen that, you've probably never heard of before in your entire life, and your listeners haven't heard of before in their entire life. And you've got advocates and surrogates who, are hosting these town halls, filling these seats of thousands of people. And so yes, Bernie and AOC, they are playing a critical role in energizing our base and taking our message across the country. But let's also not lose sight of the fact be disillusioned into thinking that, we've got the next one in the bag because we're filling stadiums and filling town halls. If you turn back to the 2020 election, between Donald Trump and Joe Biden, only one of those candidates was, filling massive arenas, by the way, during COVID, completely inappropriately and contrary to public health protocol. But there's only one candidate who was having these massive rallies and filling seats and thousands of people in arenas, and that candidate lost, and his name was Donald Trump. And despite what he said and says, he did lose that election. And so, filling seats doesn't always translate to electoral success, and we've got to keep our eye on the prize as Democrats electorally and take back the House in particular next year.
Well, and then you have the gubernatorial race coming in New York, and it looks pretty much like Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik is going to jump into the race. And you said before, New York City has certain beliefs, but once you get out of New York City, Orange County, and let's go further upstate, it's a little bit more red. So, what's your sense of if she jumps in, what her chances would be?
I'd like to think her chances are next to zero, and here's why. First, I'm old enough, and I'm not even that old, but I'm old enough to remember when Elise Stefanik was a moderate. And, she was an Ivy League, she is an Ivy League educated, should be very intelligent, was a capable moderate, open-minded thinker in Congress for a number of years. really the exact opposite of this MAGA movement that she is part and parcel to and ensconced in. She has completely betrayed her principles, her values, her education, her intellect, you name it. I could probably rattle off 15 more adjectives. She's betrayed them all. What for? For political expediency. What for? She thought, at the beginning of the year, a nice cushy post as ambassador to the United Nations before that blew up in her face. What for? Now we know what for. Plan B, to try and run statewide with the support of Donald Trump. She's pushed out a couple of other wannabe gubernatorial Republican nominees thanks to that support from Donald Trump and her sycophantic allegiance to the MAGA movement and Donald Trump. She's a different human being from when she entered politics, and not for the better, for the far worse. And so with Donald Trump in the White House, our base is very energized, and I cannot imagine that person I just described, with that belief system I just described, has any shot to win, regardless of how strong or weak the Democratic nominee winds up being. And look, we have a Democratic primary next year for governor. And so, I have no respect for Elise Stefanik. And I think once people understand her record of election denialism and all the things that New Yorkers stand against, that she's not going to have, hope and a prayer of winning a statewide race next year.
Senator Skoufis, I really was hoping you could be more clear in how you feel. That was sarcasm. I so appreciate you being with us this week on the Capitol Connection. That's Senator James Skoufis. He's a Democrat from New York's 42nd District. He comes on, he speaks his mind. You heard it. And we hope you'll come back again. Thanks so much for joining us on the Capitol Connection this week.
Certainly will come back. Thanks for having me.
Support for the Capitol Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.